This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow is the deadline set by the UN Security Council for Iran to suspend uranium enrichment, a process that can be used for nuclear power production or to build a nuclear weapon. Some hardliners and neoconservatives are calling for airstrikes and/or regime change before Iran is able to develop a nuclear bomb. My guest Michael Adeen has been calling for regime change in Iran for years, warning that Iran has been at war with us since 1979. He says the time for diplomacy is at an end. Adeen is a contributing editor for the National Review Online and resident scholar in the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a former consultant to the National Security Council and the State and Defense Departments. Adeen's latest book is The War Against the Terror Masters. In an earlier book, Perilous Statecraft, he wrote about his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan presidency. Michael Adeen, welcome to Fresh Air. If Iran continues its nuclear program and doesn't comply with the UN Security Council, what do you think the United States should do?
Well, I think the nuclear question is a bit of a diversion. That is, the problem from Iran is that they are at war with us and have been at war with us for 27 years. And mainly what they do to us is kill us and our friends and allies all over the world. And that is the central issue that should drive American policy toward Iran, not whether they do or don't have nuclear weapons. And I think that the nuclear question should not drive the strategy we devise for Iran. And I think that since we're fighting a war against terrorism, that sooner or later we're going to have to bring down that regime in Tehran. And that's the central question. And I think it also resolves at least some of the main problems associated with nuclear weapons. That is, we don't worry much about pro-Western democratic countries that have nuclear weapons, countries like India or France or Great Britain. And I would not lose much sleep over a democratically elected government in Iran because the Iranian people are overwhelmingly democratic and pro-Western and pro-American. What we worry about is nuclear weapons in the hands of these fanatics, these Islamic fascists.
Okay, so you've made it clear you'd like to see regime change in Iran, and you've been making that clear in your articles for a while now. How do you think the United States should go about that?
Same way we did with the Soviet Empire during the Cold War. That is, support the people who want to be free and who want to remove the regime. And we know how to do that. We've done it all over the world. It's a bit mysterious why we have never tried it in Iran, which is a country that famously has a very pro-American and anti-regime population. So basically, you do all the obvious things. First of all, you say, which the American government has never said, you say that you would like regime change in Iran. You would like a free government. And then you broadcast to them and you tell them every day that you want that and you give them the information they need to be able to organize it effectively themselves. So we need to do for them what Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty did for the people in the Soviet Empire during the Cold War, that is, bring them up to date on what is going on elsewhere. So the people in Tehran need to know what's going on in Isfahan, Tabriz, Shiraz, etc. So then they need to hear from people who have participated in successful nonviolent revolutions around the world so that they learn what works and what doesn't work, and they can learn from the experience of other people.
So you're making the argument that what the United States should do is help the Iranian people rise up and overthrow the current Iranian government and create a democracy there. This sounds very similar to the arguments that were made about Iraq before we invaded it. And, you know, helping people overthrow the government didn't work there. We ended up invading Iraq. And although we were told that people would really love a democracy there and they'd welcome us, what we have now is chaos in Iraq. There's still an insurgency. There's a civil war or something near civil war, depending on who's doing the describing. And the war in Iraq appears to have turned a lot of people through the region against the United States. So I'm wondering what lessons you've taken away from Iraq.
Well, we disagree on almost every element of your analysis, I guess. We never did try to support revolution in Iraq. And I'm not aware of anybody. I think that you are the first person to have suggested that we did, that I've heard anyway. Great chunks of the American government, particularly the State Department and the CIA, fought hammer and tongs against the very idea that one could have a revolution in Iraq. I disagreed with the military invasion of Iraq at the time. I thought it was a mistake. I thought it was the wrong way to do it. What I proposed was that since the Iraqi people could not possibly trust us, because another American president named George Bush had betrayed them barely 10 years before to Saddam by first calling for a Shiite and Kurdish uprising, and then when it occurred, doing nothing to protect them or defend them or support them, that they would have to see evidence that this time around we were serious. And so I suggested that we take those two no-fly zones, one in the north, one in the south, and turn them into free Iraq zones and let the Iraqis set up self-government in both of those areas, and then to call upon the rest of the Iraqi people in, let's call it Saddam's Iraq, and say to them, look, you don't have to die for this person, and we don't want to attack you. Get out. Go north. Go south. Live like free people, and you will see that we are here to liberate you and to create a free Iraq. So that was one point that I made. Just invading the country, I thought, was wrong. Secondly, I thought it was a mistake because it was an overly narrow vision of the war we were engaged in, which is a regional war in the Middle East. And anybody who was knowledgeable about the region, I thought, should recognize that if we invaded Iraq and brought down Saddam and occupied the country, that the Iranians and the Syrians were going to have to come after us. And in fact, they said so publicly before we ever went into Iraq. In fact, Bashar Assad gave an interview, open public interview, about 2 months before the start of Operation Iraqi Freedom, in which he said, when the Americans get there, that will only be the start. And then we will repeat in Iraq what we did to them earlier in Lebanon, which was the 1980s when they, in fact, drove us out of Lebanon. And that's exactly what has happened.
So that is why you are arguing in your articles now that we not only need regime change in Iran, but in Syria, too. In fact, you call it Syran, because when you talk about regime change in Iran, you also talk about Syria. So you've conflated the two and just call it Syran now. So we've got a lot of work to do if we follow your game plan with changing regimes in Iran and Syria while continuing to
have our troops in Iraq. Nobody knows how much work there is to do. I wouldn't pretend to know that. It could happen very quickly. Life is full of surprises. And certainly one of the consequences of the downfall of Saddam and our occupation of Iraq has been to inspire people all over the region to want to do the same thing to their own leaders. Now, I remember about a week after Saddam fell, Le Monde sent some journalists into the streets of Tehran interviewing people, they said at random, and asking them, well, how do you feel about all these Marines running around Baghdad? And everybody gave the same answer, which was, why are they only in Baghdad? Why don't they come to Tehran? We love Marines here.
But that was a long time ago at the beginning of the invasion. My impression now from watching the news and reading the newspapers is that the war in Iraq has helped turn people throughout the Middle East against the United States. And doesn't this challenge in some way your feeling that Iran and Syria would be happy for a pro-American regime change? I get the impression we're not real popular there right now.
Well, I don't know why you have that impression, because even things like the Pew poll show that American popularity is rising and that the people of the region really do want to be free. It's a stereotype of a certain kind of reportage that people in that part of the world really don't want freedom, and they're not really set up for self-government and so forth. But I don't believe that.
Now, you're making it clear that you don't support military regime change in Iran and Syria. On the other hand, you write, our failure to support revolution makes military action more and more likely. How likely do you think a military action in Iran or Syria is right now?
I don't know. I'm not smart enough to answer that question. All I know is that the longer we avoid what seem to be moderate, sensible, traditional kinds of solutions to the problems we face in that region, the more likely it is that an American president will arrive one day at having to decide between appeasing a nuclear Iran and bombing it. And under those circumstances, bombing it is a real option.
As we've said, the way you'd like to support regime change in Iran is to help Iranian dissidents rise up and overthrow their own government. And before the invasion of Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi was considered to be one of the Iraqi exiles and dissidents who was informed about the Iraqi people and how they could, you know, rise up, and who gave a lot of information that was published in the press and that I think the Defense Department used to plan their strategy in Iraq. Now Chalabi is accused of having leaked American intelligence information to the Iranians.
Right.
So do you feel like how betrayed do you feel by that?
Well, I don't think it's true. I can't imagine that it's true. I mean, this information comes from leaks from that same wonderful CIA who knew nothing about Iraq before we went in and who has never really had a very good appreciation of what's going on inside Iran. I don't see why I should take that seriously. And he has offered to come and testify before Congress and answer all questions and so forth, and that offer has never been picked up. I think it's just a smear. He's been smeared a lot. And his theory that it was possible to do a lot more through revolutionary activity in Iraq has never been tested, so we can't evaluate it. And certainly he was opposed to this kind of invasion.
Let me read something that you wrote recently. You wrote, "Our failure to design and conduct a serious Iran policy for so long has narrowed our options, and we may be faced with a choice among various unattractive actions. If we and our allies decide that Iranian nuclear facilities must be taken out, we should first make clear to the Iranian people that we have come slowly and reluctantly to this position, and that the regime could have avoided this terrible situation by negotiating in good faith, and that we would never dream of doing such a thing if Iran were governed by reasonable people." It sounds there like you're thinking, even though you don't support military action, that maybe it's going to happen, and when it does, we should explain it to the Iranian people.
I believe that if we are faced with those alternatives, that it will mean that we failed and failed to design a rational, sensible strategy toward dealing with Iran. I find it incredible that after 6 years in office, the Bush administration still has no Iran policy. Don't you? I mean, I think it's just amazing. Iran is arguably the central issue of the facing us in the Middle East. And we still have there's no document defining what our strategy is. There's no mission statement for what it is that we're supposed to be accomplishing there. We're just dithering around, bouncing from today's news to tomorrow's news. And that, to me, that's unacceptable. That's not the way a serious government is supposed to behave.
But it sounds from that quote that I just read that you're kind of expecting some kind of military action.
Well, I haven't seen any sign of anybody drafting a sensible policy. And I think that if you have no sensible policy, you are ultimately faced with terrible alternatives. And we may well end up there. Look, I am not a prophet. And prophecy is a very dangerous business. I'm an historian. And looking at the history of policymaking on this kind of question, when you come to dreadful alternatives, if you just look back a bit, you can see that if you had acted earlier and more moderately, you didn't have to deal with that sort of alternative. That's what I'm worried about.
You've been supporting regime change in Iran for a long time. What do you think the consequences to the United States will be if there is not regime change?
We'll continue to be faced with this extremely hostile regime, which I think I was the first person to call a clerical fascist regime, which I wrote back in 1979. And they will continue to wage war against us in their way, and they will continue until they have either won or lost. It's not a very pleasant scenario, but I think it's as close to a sure thing as I can imagine.
So you see Iran in the context of a larger battle between the West and extreme Islam, and I mean, do you see this as a fight to the death?
I didn't say that, and I'm not sure I believe that. I don't see this as a war between Islam and the West, and I disagree with people who take that position.
I'm sorry for misinterpreting you. That's how it was sounding.
Yeah, no,
me.
I was talking about Iran, and I was calling the Iranian regime a clerical fascist regime. Khomeini is a classical clerical fascist. I mean, I wrote my doctoral dissertation and several books about fascism, and in the scholarly literature, there is a category of fascism which is called clerical fascism, which was originally applied, by the way, to Christian clerical fascists in Romania at the same time as the Third Reich and Mussolini and so forth. But the and Khomeini fits that model of fascism perfectly, and this regime is exactly that. So I think Senator Santorum, for example, is well within his rights to talk about Islamic fascism. I think that's technically correct. But I'm just talking, you asked me a question about Iran, and I was answering a question about Iran. I wasn't talking about Islam in general. I don't think that Islam is predestined to wage jihad against the West forever. I think there is at the moment a strain of Islam which is jihadist and which is waging war against us. But I don't think it was inevitable, and I don't think there's any reason why it has to continue.
But just, again, getting back to the consequences that you think we will face if we don't have regime change in Iran, do you see Iran's extremist Islamic leadership spreading? Do you think it's already spread? I mean, what do you think will be the larger impact if the current regime remains in power?
I can't answer that. I don't know what will happen. Nobody knows what will happen. All we can say with certainty, I think this is as close to certainty as you can have, is that they have been attacking us for 27 years and they will continue to attack us. Everything they say leads to that conclusion. Everything they do leads to that conclusion. Why would you think that anything other than that will happen?
But when you say they've been attacking us for 27 years, I mean, do you hold Iran responsible for al-Qaeda, which is the group that actually attacked us on American soil?
How shall I answer this? All I said was that Iran has been attacking us for 27 years. I didn't say that Iran is responsible for every attack against us.
No, but the attack that's happened on American soil was the one by al-Qaeda.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe there was a relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda, but I'm not making that accusation. I'm simply saying...
When you say they've attacked us for 27 years, what are the attacks that you're referring to?
Well, how many would you like? There was the seizure of the hostages in Tehran. There was the bombing of the American embassy in Beirut. There was the bombing of the American Marine barrack in Beirut. There was the attack against Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia.
So you've named like four or five attacks.
Well, I can name more, but
you know,
we don't have all day. But there's an awful lot. There are the attacks against American forces in Iraq today, which are heavily supported by Iran. The IEDs that are blowing up American troops along highways in Iraq are manufactured in Iran and come in from Iran as well as from Syria. There are Iranian Revolutionary Guards intelligence officers all over Iran. Israel found that when they went into Lebanon, they found Iranian military intelligence officers standing alongside Hezbollah.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
You bet. The thing that most perplexes me about the policy debate in the United States these days, and it's been true for several years, is how it is that people who hold the views that I hold, which are to support democratic revolution all over the world, not just in Iran, but all over the world, have come somehow to be called conservatives, when revolution is, by definition, a radical event. It's the opposite of conservatism. It calls for fundamental change. And I can compare it to a question that Leo Strauss once asked about the word virtue. He said, how did it happen that a word, virtue, that used to stand for the manliness of men, came to mean the virginity of women or the chastity of women, which is a very dramatic change? And so it is that you have a lot of people today who are advocating revolution and support for democratic revolution against tyranny have come to be mystified, I would argue, as conservatives. And it's perplexing. And I think it shows the degree to which people really have trouble understanding what is going on and the implications of various kinds of policy prescriptions.
Do you think of yourself as a revolutionary?
Well, sure. I'm advocating revolution. I've advocated revolution all my life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Michael Ledeen is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor for the National Review Online.